Great ocean like this, far from land. Have you ever seen anything so beautiful?
I admit, it's magical. But I still prefer the mountains.
He could just catch the scent of her freshly washed hair, and he felt the same hopeless attraction wash over him. Part of him wished there were no Alex Lispinard on board to torment his dreams and disturb his peace of mind, but mostly he was glad of her presence and friendship, even if she did beat him relentlessly in backgammon. That observation you made about the bodies not decomposing was really disturbing. At that depth and pressure, salt water is like a mild acid. It goes to work on organic remains right away. You may recall that no human remains were found with the Titanic, not even bones. While most of that was done by scavengers and tube worms, the seawater and pressure sure helped it along. I can see why the baobab thing might excrete chemicals that kill off the surrounding microbial life, but how would it stop the action of pressure and salt? That's the mystery. Silence fell. They remained at the railing. Alex was so close to him, her arm was brushing his. She had turned her head toward him, and he in turn swiveled to look at her. Their faces were very close. He resisted the impulse to lean in and kiss her. Instead, she kissed him. Her lips were soft and warm. The kiss lingered for a long, slow moment, and then her lips parted, and their tongues touched. He reached up and stroked her hair, pulling her toward him in a deep, long embrace. She withdrew, smiling. Gideon was so out of breath he couldn't speak. He leaned in to kiss her again, but she stopped him with her finger. Not where we might be seen. Right. He wondered where this was going. Why she'd changed her mind about shipboard romances. He knew this was probably not a good idea for either of them, but at the moment he really, truly didn't care.
We haven't done any magic tricks together, she said in a low voice.
I'm not sure I can teach you anything.
Oh, I don't know. There are always new tricks.
She paused.
Do you still have that bottle of Veuve Clicquot?
I've been saving it.
She took his arm.
Let's go enjoy it.
He looked at her a long time. He couldn't believe this was happening. All right. They walked back into the Batavia's interior, arm in arm. It was almost midnight, and most of the ship, except for the bridge and the night watch, had gone to bed. Down through the corridors and passageways they walked, and into his stateroom. To his relief, they met nobody along the way. He closed the door behind them with his foot. Silently, they came together and kissed again. She began unbuttoning his shirt, slowly, and he did the same with her blouse. He resisted the impulse to tear off all her clothes. She pulled the shirt over his head and ran her fingernails lightly along his chest.
I like this.
He tossed her blouse aside, unhooked her bra, and released her breasts, cupping them in his hands. He lightly ran his fingers around her nipples, feeling them stiffen at his touch. He could hear her breath quicken. Her hand crept down his stomach and slid under his belt buckle.
Want to teach me some magic?
Yes, was all he could manage to say. They made love slow, deep, and hard. Afterward, he lay collapsed on top of her, kissing her lazily. Then he propped himself up, looking down at her lips, her nose, her hair disheveled over the pillow, her eyes looking into his.
We forgot the champagne, she said.
It's still there, waiting for us.
They looked at each other for a long time.
What about your, you know, rule about no romance on board ship? Gideon asked at last.
Oh, well, she shrugged. I just couldn't stop myself.
You mean this isn't just a moment of weakness never to be repeated?
I've been thinking about doing this for 32 days, she said. I'm afraid I'm hooked. There's no going back now.
For 32 days? I had no idea.
Come on, all those backgammon games, all the time we spent together. You men just don't have a clue, do you?
But why now?
It was when you went down alone this morning, insisted on it, said there was no point in arguing, told me to fuck off. It sure made me mad, but oddly enough, it also made you irresistible. I didn't expect you to be so forceful, knowing how afraid you are of the deep.
He shook his head. It was Eli's idea, to be honest.
Well, he admitted that when I escalated the issue, complained to him. But you did it. A silence.
So, is this for real?
I hope so.
Are we going to hide it?
She laughed. On board ship? Impossible. But as long as we're discreet, I doubt anyone will object.
Eli might.
Are you kidding? With all his psychological profiling, I imagine he expected this.
Maybe he even engineered it to happen. Which is why he suggested you lead the recon.
He's the world's most skillful manipulator. But in this case, it was a good manipulation.
Speaking of manipulation, he looked down at her naked body, still unable to believe what had just happened, how suddenly his fortunes had changed.
Uh-oh, she said. Is something happening down there again? So soon? Chapter 14 Three DSVs had been removed from the hangar deck, and now rested on the fantail, casting long shadows in the golden light of morning. Gideon arrived a few minutes before the scheduled briefing, cup of coffee in hand, pleasantly exhausted by the long night of lovemaking. Alex was already there, dressed in a sleek black leotard-like outfit, as if channeling the Avengers' Emma Peel. She looked well-rested, intimidatingly so, he thought, all things considered. Manuel Garza had arrived as well and was chatting with Alex. To Gideon's surprise, he appeared to be dressed for a dive.
"Hello, Gideon," said Garza, offering his hand.
Gideon took it. He thought Garza looked a little nervous, but maybe that was wishful thinking.
"So, you're piloting a DSV too?"
"Assigned to George. You're going down in John."
"And I'm in Paul," said Alex, sauntering over.
Gideon tried to maintain a nonchalant look and avoid staring. He glanced around at the others in view. A few DSV techs and the ship's second engineer, Greg Masterson, a powerfully built man, who was on hand to look over the DSV's engines and give the dive a green light.
Did they know? But there weren't any knowing glances, just an air of professional gravity.
"Coffee before a dive?" Alex asked, arching her eyebrows. "That's brave."
"How so?" "Coffee's a diuretic."
Gideon hadn't thought of that, although he had already been down twice.
What happens if you have to pee?"
"In your pants." Gideon set his coffee cup aside. A deck door opened, and Glynn emerged, limping ever so slightly, carrying an iPad and blinking in the bright sunlight. He clasped his hands behind his back and bestowed on them a cool smile of welcome.
"Nice day for a dive," he said. "We've been lucky in the weather."
Nods of agreement.
"You've all studied the mission plan, but I'm going to run through the main points briefly and see if there are any questions."
He paused. Gideon glanced surreptitiously at Alex. Her eyes were on Glynn.
With an effort, he turned back to the briefing.
"First, a word about communications. Unlike yesterday, all of you will be in communication with Mission Control via your UQC underwater phones. The UQC is an acoustical modem that operates at a speed of 1200 baud maximum, very slow. It can carry voice communications and minimal data, but almost all the heavy data has to be archived for downloading once you surface. We'll deploy special sonobuoys above where you're working to pick up the signals and relay them to Mission Control. But, because of the minuscule throughput, there will be a time delay before we'll actually be able to view them on the surface. Also, because these are acoustical signals, they're easily blocked."
Gideon,
When you're inside the Rolvag, your communications will be temporarily cut off, not just from Mission Control, but from the other DSVs.
Gideon nodded.
The two black boxes are vital. One contains all data and communications to and from the ship's bridge. The second stored the CCTV video from security cameras set up throughout the ship. If we can recover both, we'll have a detailed picture of the ship's last moments. We know exactly where they're located, in the electronics hub on the forecastle deck. With the Rolvag lying on its side, you'll have to enter the hull, make your way through the wreckage of the hold and beyond to a point underneath the forecastle deck, then cut through the deck to reach the electronics hub. The route has been fully programmed into your DSV, but we don't know the condition or layout of the interior. So once you enter the hull, you'll have to use your own judgment. The John has a cutting torch on its mech arm. It's AI-assisted, so there's no fear of making a mistake.
Questions?
Not at the moment.
Glynn shifted, turning toward Alex.
Since we can't map the, baobab with sonar, we'll scan it using visual light and LIDAR. That's your job. The LIDAR is a green wavelength laser capable of penetrating 60 feet of water. We need to know the extent of this thing, not only the trunk, but its branches as well. Also, what are those tendrils Gideon saw on the ocean floor, and how far out do they go? And do they go to anything in particular?
Gideon, looking at Alex again as Glynn spoke, found his mind wandering back to the previous night. He quickly squashed the vivid images that rose in his mind. Given his own precarious medical condition, he thought, what was he doing, getting into a relationship like this? Following the awful events that had transpired during their time on the Lost Island in the Caribbean, Glynn had healed amazingly well, and Gideon still held out some hope he might also be cured of his condition. Or was that just wishful thinking? As of yet, there was no evidence that anything had medically changed, no evidence that he might have any longer than 9 months left to live. Was he becoming an old softy? Or did this really feel, already, like more than a shipboard romance? What the hell should he do? Once again, he made a mighty effort to tune back in to Glynn, who was now talking to Garza.
Manuel, you will undertake a high-resolution sonar and LIDAR scan of the Rolvag and the surrounding sea floor, extending out a radius of half a mile. I also want to do a 5-mile transect, starting at the baobab and going out, to see how far the dead zone extends.
Glynn looked at the three in turn.
Finally, all three DSVs today are equipped with science baskets. If you see something interesting, notify Mission Control. We will use the UQC to look at it and decide whether it can be picked up and brought to the surface. If so, you'll use your mechanical arms to place it in the science basket. The operation of the arm is simple and it, too, is AI-assisted, so previous experience is not required.
He ran through a few more details, then finished with a simple, "Let's mount up."
Gideon climbed his submersible's ladder up to the sail hatch. He stood there a moment, looking at the other two, watching as Alex gave him a smile and a wave, then lowered herself gracefully through the hatch. A moment later, he grasped the bar and stepped into his own hatch, climbing down the miniature ladder into the personnel sphere. Unlike the previous day, he felt calm and confident. 10 minutes later, Gideon once again found himself staring through the forward viewport at a swirl of silver bubbles, as John was lowered into the water. He heard the clank as the DSV was released and watched through the viewports as he drifted down into the infinite, darkening blue.
Chapter 15. Out of his right and left viewports, Gideon could see the yellow gleam of lights from his two companion DSVs, drifting down at approximately the same rate. He could hear the faint hiss of the air tanks and CO2 scrubbers. During the 40-minute trip to the bottom,
He eventually lost them in the blackness. After a long, boring ride, he picked up their lights again as they slowed, nearing the bottom. His first waypoint was a spot 50 meters from the split hull of the Rolvog, at an altitude of 30 feet off the ocean floor. The autopilot gently brought him to the waypoint, the sub coming to rest. Gideon looked about, rotating the sub and peering into the gloom. He could see, a few hundred yards to his left, the blurry cluster of lights from Alex's DSV, Paul, also hovering 30 feet above the seabed. Through the forward viewport, he saw a similar cluster of lights from George. Following protocol, he made contact using the UQC. John, at waypoint 1, calling Paul. Paul here, I read you, at waypoint 2. John, calling George.
George here, I read you, at waypoint 3.
These names, Gideon thought, were starting to feel a little silly. Glynn's voice came in, from control, inflected with digital distortion. They were all on the same channel, and they now made their way through a set of safety checklists and review of the search protocols.
"Commence the mission," said Glynn at last.
Gideon moved the central joystick, aiming the autopilot toward the Rolvog. The engines hummed, and the craft moved forward, approaching the wreck, headlights illuminating the gaping, petaled hull. Inside, he could see what looked like a forest of twisted metal beams. He felt not a little twinge of claustrophobia at the thought of going in there. On a flat panel to his right, there was a schematic of the wrecked ship. This was overlaid by a blinking red dot, indicating his location. The black boxes appeared on the panel as a small orange target. The ship was huge. Judging from the schematic, he would have to travel almost 200 yards from the point of entry. As he moved toward the gaping hull, the little red dot moved on the screen. In the background, he could hear Alex on the common frequency, speaking to Mission Control while she maneuvered Paul toward the Baobab. Manuel's voice came through as well, as he circled the area, surveying the ship and surrounding debris field.
"Gideon," Glynn had told him, "when you're inside the Rolvag, you'll be temporarily cut off, not just from Mission Control, but from the other DSVs."
During the briefing, Gideon had learned that the normally open hull of the former supertanker, the Rolvog, had been modified. It was webbed with struts and beams that braced the so-called cradle intended to hold the 25,000-ton meteorite. Some of the beams, and the cradle itself, had been made of wood, because wood was a more flexible and giving material than steel, and the EES engineers had determined it would hold up better to the rolling of the ship in a storm, should they encounter one. They had indeed encountered a storm, a terrible one, made worse by the lack of engine power and damage to the ship inflicted by the pursuing Chilean destroyer. The rocking of the meteorite had eventually weakened the cradle and caused it to break loose, followed by an explosion that split the ship in two just as it was starting to sink. The source of this explosion had never been determined, but the theory was that the meteorite had reacted with the seawater. As he moved toward the vast, wrecked area of the gigantic hold, the voices of George and Paul began to dissolve into digital static. Gideon paused at the hull opening and used his controls to shine the spotlight around, probing the recesses ahead. It was a mess. He saw what he believed must be a portion of the former cradle, a huge, sled-like object, mangled and splintered, jammed up against a broken bulkhead. The forward part of the hull offered a relatively clear pathway for his DSV, but deeper in, he saw a tangle of cables and struts that would have to be dealt with.
"Control, this is John, entering the hull."
The briefest of pauses over the low-baud UQC. Then, full of static, "John, we read you. Report back as soon as you can." He eased the stick forward. The DSV hummed as it entered the wrecked space. Skirting a massive, torn edge of slab steel, he moved deeper into the hold. Without any effort on his part, the sub smoothly avoided some hanging cables and a strut, The hiss of UQC now ceased entirely, and a message appeared on the screen, indicating he had lost communications. Bubbles rose in front of the main viewport. A layer of silt lay over everything, softening the contours. He would have to take great care not to stir it up. He was moving at the pace of a walk. Orange blobs of rust grew from the iron struts and particles drifted in the water, dancing sluggishly through his light. Below, the side of the hull was littered with splintered beams and struts, torn to pieces by the violence of the explosion. The splintered wood, while waterlogged and sunken, looked fresh. Clearly, this had been a massive explosion, strong enough to bulge out the iron hull plates, pop the rivets. There was another body here, wearing a mechanic's uniform, head torn away, crushed torso held in place by two broken beams. Averting his eyes, Gideon checked the schematic. The red dot that represented his sub was now a third of the way to the access point inside the hull space. A tangle of I-beams loomed ahead. The autopilot slowed, and he moved the joystick, looking for a way around. There was a space between two girders that looked big enough, and he aimed for it, the autopilot easing through with finesse. But it was beginning to feel as if he were in a shattered forest after a battle, the girders like warped, broken trees. He probed this way and that through the maze-like jungle, each time finding a hole just wide enough to get through. As he penetrated deeper into the wreck, it grew increasingly difficult to shake off the feeling of claustrophobia. The radio silence didn't help. Gideon began to feel very much alone. Or was he? Because, strange as it seemed, he was also aware of a sense of being watched, followed. He dismissed this as best he could. It was the sort of anxiety that occurred when walking in a dark forest at night, he told himself, and it dated back to the early days when humans were, in fact, hunted. And hadn't he compared this environment to a forest, albeit a wrecked one? And now, quite suddenly, he reached a point through which there seemed no way to pass. He maneuvered forward, slowly, until he was blocked. He turned one way, then another, and then another. There seemed no passage forward. Hovering in place like this, his engine stirred up the silt. He could no longer tell from which direction he'd come. Jesus, what was I thinking? Agreeing to pilot my way through hundreds of yards of wreckage miles below the surface? No way do I have the experience to do this. And now I've gotten myself trapped. And can't call for help. He started to panic, then quickly forced himself to calm down. The autopilot would, of course, know the way out. But to go farther, he'd have to do some cutting. Doing his best to breathe slowly and deeply, he centered his attention on the beam blocking his way and raised the robotic arm, activating the underwater acetylene torch. It had its own set of controls and, to his relief, was surprisingly easy to use. The arm seeming to know exactly what he wanted it to do. Another example of a quasi-AI automatic control. The torch popped to life, sending up a stream of bubbles and a white pinpoint flare. He maneuvered it toward the beam and began cutting, careful to make the cut slanted so the beam would fall away from him. But the AI software of the arm already knew that. In a few minutes, with a muffled snap, the beam toppled away, and he was able to proceed. He continued maneuvering, this time to the left, and paused to cut through another beam. Now his spotlight shone on the bulkhead of the forecastle deck. Because the ship was lying on its side, the deck was a vertical wall of steel, which made it much easier to deal with. His screen schematic showed him exactly where he was supposed to cut in order to reach the electronics hub, where the two black boxes, actually orange in color, were stored. A second flat panel contained a diagram of the hub's interior, indicating the exact location of the boxes. They should be easy to get at, as they were supposedly designed for ready access in a wrecked ship at depth. He maneuvered the DSV to align it with the pre-programmed cutting lines, and then, with a mere touch of the controls, the arm flared once again into life. The protocol called for cutting the access opening in 5 stages, removing 5 smaller plates of steel, each cut designed so that the plates would drop away and not present a further obstacle. Practically by rote, the mech arm cut the plates with unerring precision, and one by one, they fell away. In 10 minutes, the hole was big enough for the DSV to pass through. But still impeding the opening was a forest of pipes between the decking, and he had to cut through each pipe in turn. They, too, fell away cleanly. Gideon positioned the sub and probed the space ahead with the spotlight before entering. It was an utter mess. The cabinets that once held computers and electronics had burst open, spewing their guts everywhere. The space was a tangle of wires, bundles, cables, and fiber optic. As if that weren't enough, beyond the tangle of wires was a body, arms and legs splayed, slowly drifting about, neutrally buoyant. Long blonde hair floated in the silty cloud. It was the body of a woman. It was clothed in a uniform. 4 bars. A captain. What was the name of the Rolvog's captain? Britton. Sally Britton. So this was her. Gideon felt a strange mixture of regret and horror. The corpse had its back to him and floated in the middle of the room, turning ever so slowly in what seemed a slow-motion ballet. Behind the corpse, on the far wall, were 2 bright orange cubes, each about 18 inches square, affixed to the wall with easily removable bolts, and with nothing nearby to impede access. Except the floating body. Gideon eased forward, extending the robotic arm. He lit the torch and cut his way through the cables. In a few minutes, he had cleared a path and eased into it, approaching the corpse. With the arm extended, he gently touched its torso, attempting to nudge it to a far corner. The push was uneven and caused the body to rotate more, turning to face him as it drifted away, arms outstretched, as if yearning to be rescued. Gideon stared in fascinated horror. The face was perfectly preserved, the blue eyes flashing in the intensity of the headlights, the mouth partly open, just a bit of pink tongue visible, the blonde hair swirling into a coil of gold. A woman of about 40, attractive, even in death. Perhaps harder than he intended, he pushed the joystick forward, and the DSV surged past the body. Reaching the orange boxes, he used the arm to pull the emergency bolts and put each box into the science basket in turn, securing them with tie-downs designed for the purpose. Now to get the hell out. Twisting the joystick, the sub made a 180, and once again, the body came into view, drifting toward him as if to block his way. Son of a bitch, Gideon muttered, maneuvering around it and heading for the hole he'd cut in the bulkhead. A few keystrokes on the control board, and the sub's autopilot was retracing its route, with no input from him, and doing it perfectly. In 10 minutes, he could see the ragged edges of the hull, and in another 2, he was outside the ship. He found himself taking deep gulps of air, as if emerging from a cave. The vice-like feeling of claustrophobia ebbed, and he mopped his brow, trying to get his heart rate back to normal. The UQC crackled back into life, the voices of Control and the other 2 subs resuming. Thank God. He radioed up.
Control, this is John. Mission accomplished. Black boxes retrieved.
Very good, came Glynn's voice. Proceed to Waypoint 1 and commence transmitting your data and the video feeds. You're the first to complete your mission, so hold tight at the waypoint until all 3 of you are ready to ascend together.
Roger that.
He entered the pre-programmed waypoint into his control stack, and the mini-sub glided back to the location, about 100 yards from the wreck, then came to a hovering stop. Gazing through the forward viewport, he saw a single tentacle from the anomalous life form wandering across the mud. It looked like a thin snake or a worm of endless length.
He thought of the huge baobab-like thing towering above them all, and felt a shiver of both disgust and dread.
Then, shaking these feelings away, he settled in, preparing to transmit his data stream while waiting for the others to complete their assignments.
Chapter 16. Eli Glynn preferred to stand, even to the point of exhaustion. He could never get enough of standing. He had been in a wheelchair for so long, he felt he had done enough sitting for a lifetime. As a result, in anticipation of being liberated from his wheelchair, he had designed the central command console of Mission Control in a U-shaped form, the keyboards and screens positioned for the height for a standing man, with no chair or option to sit. If others had to stand when in control, so be it. But now he was in control, the others in the room at their own distant posts. He was surrounded by screens, and he carefully shifted his attention among them, from one to the next, so as not to miss any development. So far, things had gone well. While he knew it was pure superstition, Glynn did not feel comfortable when everything went as planned. Perfection seemed a mockery to him. In his view, perfection was not only impossible, but the enemy of success. The real key was flexibility in the face of the unexpected, or, as someone once said, the known unknowns. But he was willing to accept each accomplishment as it came, realizing that much more difficult decisions and greater unknowns lay ahead. John, under Gideon's control, had been inside the wreck for 30 minutes, unable to transmit due to interference from the hull. The baud rate on the UQC was abysmally low, even in the best of circumstances, acceptable for voice but a mere soda straw for data. He wanted to see what the interior of the ship looked like. Suddenly, he heard Gideon's voice pop back on the frequency. "Control, this is John. Mission accomplished. Black boxes retrieved." "Very good," Glynn said. "Proceed to Waypoint 1 and commence transmitting your data and the video feeds." A few minutes of silence. Then, "This is John, back at Waypoint 1. Transmitting." "Understood," said Glynn. "Any issues?" Another briefer silence. "No. Except I encountered another two corpses." Glynn did not inquire further. He would see it soon enough on video. He shifted his attention to the other two DSVs. Garza was fully engaged in mapping, and he, too, was ahead of schedule, with just the 5-mile transect remaining. Lispinard was cautiously circling the baobab, moving higher in a spiraling fashion, using LIDAR to scan the entity at millimeter-level resolution, as well as videoing it in visible light. So far, there had been no sign of life from the baobab. No sign, in fact, of anything. It was inert. That concerned Glynn. A faint beep from the console indicated the compressed video upload from Gideon was complete. Glynn hesitated and then tapped a few keys, directing the upload to play on a spare screen at 4 times normal speed. He watched in silence as the sub passed through the open hull and made its way deeper into the ship. The explosion had blown away most of the bracing around the cradle and reduced it to a splintered hulk. The force of the compression could be clearly seen radiating from the cradle. No question, the meteorite, the seed, had reacted violently on coming in contact with salt water. Perhaps this was the beginning of its sprouting process, if indeed the word sprout could be applied. So far, they had gathered no evidence this was a plant, nor the meteorite an actual seed. It could be anything. Spore, rhizome, egg, gametophyte. Or it could be something utterly alien. Even though he had been there in that hole during those final critical moments, Glynn reminded himself once again to stay detached, not to make assumptions. He cut the playback speed to normal time.
On the screen, Gideon cut through the blocking struts. Glynn watched as the sub's mech arm then cut a hole in the decking below the electronics hub and moved into the space, slicing away the deck piping as it did so. And then Glynn froze. There was one of the corpses Gideon had mentioned. In uniform. 4 bars on the sleeves. The captain. He felt a sudden, strange buzzing in his head. The body, its back turned, blonde hair floating, was slowly rotating, turning its face toward him. Glynn experienced a momentary cessation of thought, and then, despite all his carefully constructed defenses, his deliberate blocking out of certain memories for so long, the pain came rushing in, along with the sick horror of her death, a death for which he was responsible. Here it was, his guilt, in the very flesh, come back to haunt him. A single decision had done this. The most inexplicable decision of his life, a decision he believed at the time was founded on logic, but which, in retrospect, was the product of emotion, fear, and panic. A decision that had forever stripped him of certitude and self-confidence. And it was a decision that led to the death of the only woman he had ever loved. He could not breathe as he watched the body turn toward him, the hair forming a golden halo. He did not want to see the face, which he knew even now would be a sight to haunt him forever. But he was paralyzed. He could not turn away. The face came slowly into view, profile first, then full on, like a moon rotating on its axis. Lips pink, skin as pure as marble, the small nose dusted with freckles. But worst of all were the eyes, those staring blue eyes, coming around to drill into him, accusatory. His legs began to shake, but before he could seek a chair, he felt all muscle tension slacken, and he folded to the floor. After that, there was only a confused jumble, muffled shouts, people bending over, Bramble's bald and shining head, the sting of a needle, the sensation of being lifted, the murmured commands, and a welcoming absence of thought. Chapter 17. Alex Lispinard worked her DSV controls, circling the trunk of the baobab from a distance of about 40 feet. The trunk was massive, far larger than even the largest sequoia, around 60 feet in diameter, and covered with a rough, bark-like surface of crude, parallel vertical grooves. As her spotlight probed the trunk, she could see it was vaguely translucent, almost like a cloudy jellyfish, of a pale greenish color like sea glass. Within, she could see the blurry outlines of what appeared to be internal organs, folded tubes and sacs that made no sense, looking like no terrestrial organism she knew of. There were also some round globules with a yellowish tinge, along with spidery networks of darker, reddish strands. The entity's flesh was scattered with shining flecks and spots that drifted around in slow motion, like snow in a snow globe. It was simultaneously beautiful and grotesque. From this vantage point, seeing the complexity inside, it appeared to her more animal than plant, or perhaps something in between. And yet so far, she had seen nothing that looked like sensory or feeding organs. Nor did it seem to have a mouth or anus. At any rate, she was getting everything on video and LIDAR. They would have plenty of time to examine the images and scans topside, and try to determine how the creature lived, how it fed, what it needed to stay alive, assuming, of course, it was alive. She continued her slow circuit, maintaining a spiral pattern in order to create a three-dimensional, digitized model of the thing. In another loop, she would have reached the point where the branches forked out, not like a tree, but all at once, to form a kind of starburst pattern like a sea anemone. Sea anemone. Once you got past the scale of the thing, she thought, it did vaguely resemble a sea anemone. Although the branches looked rigid, not like the flexible tentacles of an anemone, and Alex saw no signs of stinging cnidocytes on them. At the very base of the fork, she noted something unusual, a dark, oval shape deep inside. It was the size of a large watermelon, and it looked out of place to her somehow, as if it didn't belong with the rest of the creature. "Control, this is Paul," she said. "I see something unusual at the fork in the trunk. Something dark." A brief pause.
"Okay, we see it," came the voice of Chief Officer Leonard.
Alex wondered briefly what had happened to Glenn.
"It doesn't look like the surrounding tissue. Request permission to take a closer look."
"Permission denied."
Alex swallowed her momentary irritation. She wondered how Gideon would react to such an order. At the thought of Gideon, a small smile formed on her face. Then her lips set once again in a straight, determined line. The sub came around, the autopilot accomplishing its complex spiraling maneuver without effort. She had reached the forking section of the trunk. As the DSV rose above the fork, she looked down and, at last, saw what could only be a mouth, a round opening, 3 feet in diameter, surrounded by what appeared to be 3 sets of clear, rubbery lips. It was flexing rhythmically, as if pumping water in and out.
"I think we just found its mouth," she said, "and from what I can see, it's very much alive."
"Stay well away," warned Leonard.
"It looks like it's sucking in water, filter feeding."
The pulsing, rubbery, huge, translucent lips were truly disgusting. Alex shuddered. Now the sub commenced another autopiloted loop above the mouth, taking in the sudden coruscation of branches. She could see, deep below the mouth, the dark, melon-shaped object she had noticed earlier.
"Hey, I think that dark shape I mentioned earlier is something it swallowed."
More scanning.
"Wait, the mouth stopped flexing."
"Noted."
"It's gone still."
"Back off to 200 feet. Send Leonard sharply.
"Roger."
Lispinar touched the joystick and sent the sub on a radial away from the mouth. Suddenly, she felt a lurch. An alarm went off in the sub and a flashing message appeared on the main screen. Warning. Strong current detected. She instinctively knew what it was, and a quick glance at the hideous mouth confirmed it. The orifice had expanded grotesquely, the lips protruding, the whole thing sucking in water at an abruptly increased pace. She grabbed the joystick and gave it full reverse, the engine thrumming up fast, arresting the forward movement of the sub.
"Get out now,"
she heard Leonard say in her headset.
"Back away, full power."
This was what she was already doing, but now the mouth ballooned further, the lips stretching, and the current increased. The sub shook and rocked in its effort to pull free. Lispinard pushed the joystick sideways and rotated the sub, trying to exit the current diagonally. For a moment, it seemed to work. The sub jerked violently sideways and almost broke free. But then the mouth gulped more water, swelling like an enormous toad, snagging her once again in its suction.
"Not free yet!"
She struggled to keep the sub stable in the vortex created by the flow of water, the mouth seeming to loom ever bigger. Such a huge current had been generated by the suction that now a curtain of silt was rising in plumes from the ocean floor, or was it caused by the motion of the roots? As the sub began to spin, she slammed the joystick sideways, trying to break free of the maelstrom, to no avail.
"Emergency eject,"
Leonard said.
"Trigger the eject."
Alex reached for the red eject lever, but was thrown back by an unexpected lurch. And then, the mini-sub was suddenly swallowed in a green, milky globe of light, the creature's translucent tissue flaring in the headlamps. She both heard and felt a wet, sucking sound, as she could see the tissue flecked with bright specks, flexing and contracting horribly, as the thing swallowed her whole.
"I'm inside," she said, doing her best to keep her voice even.
"Use the torch arm! Cut your way out!"
was the last message she heard before the UQC ceased working,
the acoustic connection crackling out into digital hiss. She activated the arm and tried to extend it, but the pressure of the thing's internal tissue blocked any movement. She tried a second time, pushing the joystick all the way forward, but now multiple alarms were going off, warning messages flashing everywhere. Screw this. She activated the acetylene torch, the flame flaring into life. The effect was instantaneous. A sudden, jerking reaction, along with a low, booming groan. And then she managed to pull the emergency eject, designed to jettison the titanium personnel sphere from the subhousing, inflate the ballast tanks, and send it screaming to the surface. Chapter 18. Gideon throttled his DSV to its max as he sped toward the scene of the disaster. He had heard the exchange over the UQC and watched in horror as the lights of Alex's sub winked out as it was apparently swallowed. But they were not gone entirely. There was a ghastly, greenish glow now from inside the creature, and as he approached, he could even see the dark, blurry outline of the sub. The titanium sphere, he knew, was incredibly strong, resistant to pressure down to a depth of 3 miles. She would be safe inside it. She could cut her way out of the baobab with the torch or, perhaps, irritate the creature enough to regurgitate her. Gideon, came Leonard's voice. What are you doing? He didn't bother to answer, keeping himself focused, cursing the slowness of the sub's propulsion. Your orders are to remain at the waypoint. The hell with orders. As he closed in, he could now make out sounds. Not digitally through the UQC, but through the water itself, picked up by his sub's exterior hydrophone and broadcast into the interior. He turned up the gain. There's nothing you can do. Stop now. A sloppy, wet groaning sound filled his capsule, along with a rapid clicking, overlain by some kind of low rumble. Stay back, Gideon. That's a direct order. Ignoring this, he dropped down, coming in low, only 10 feet above the sea floor. If he approached the creature from below, the mouth wouldn't be able to reach him. He'd cut into its trunk with his torch, chop the whole damn thing down if that's what was necessary. But even as he descended, he saw, inside the monster, the sudden bright spark of Alex's own acetylene torch lighting up, and, in reaction, the upper trunk of the creature flexing abruptly. The lights of her sub winked out, and there was a muffled, popping sound. A huge, roiling belch of air bubbles was expelled from the creature's mouth. She'd hit the eject. The creature writhed horribly, but the sub didn't emerge, didn't break free. More air erupted. No! Gideon cried. Now the trunk was warping toward him, bulging grotesquely like a puff adder. Gideon! Came Leonard's voice. What you're doing is suicide! Get the hell away from it! He lit his torch, waving it at the creature as he motored forward. A tiny voice in his head told him that this was crazy, David coming at Goliath, but he pushed it aside. Through the forward viewport, he saw one of the strangely thin tentacles of the creature whipping sinuously across the ocean floor. He had to do something now. He pushed the joystick down, reached the root, halted, and extended his torch, slashing at it, the heat making it pop and sizzle like seared meat. The tentacle coiled frantically, causing silt to cloud the water. He slashed again, each movement riling up more silt and engulfing him in hazy darkness. An all-too-familiar message popped on the screen. Control transferred to surface. He felt the joystick stop responding. No! He cried. We're getting you out of there. And now the sub started to rise. The silt cleared and Gideon, in a last, spontaneous move, grabbed a long, floating section of root that he'd chopped free with a mechanical arm and stuffed it into the science basket next to the black boxes. And then a voice came through the hydrophone. It was Alex's voice, calm, pleasant, remote as the stars. Let me touch your face. Chapter 19. The seedily dressed man wheeled his cheap roller bag down Santa Fe's West San Francisco Street. He passed a Starbucks and hesitated, craving a venti macchiato, or even a single shot of espresso, but realized he didn't have the money. Turning down Galisteo Street, he stopped at a shopfront with a sign identifying it as Professor Exotica. It sported a window stuffed with bizarre and fantastical rocks, minerals, gems, and fossils. There was a cave bear skull mounted, a dinosaur egg, a mummified crocodile, a spectacular azurite geode, a 4-inch tourmaline, and a large, sectioned meteorite with its etched face displaying a riot of Widmanstätten lines. The man paused at the window. He hadn't called ahead to make an appointment, but the proprietor, a guy named Joe Culp, was almost always there. Besides, an appointment hadn't seemed like a good idea. The last one hadn't gone all that well, and he'd been afraid of being turned away before he even got in the door. He collapsed the handle of the roller bag, then picked it up. Jesus, it was heavy. Maybe 80, 90 pounds. But that weight was what was going to buy his dinner and a place to spend the night. He pushed through the door, bells tinkling, and lugged the bag down the staircase into the basement shop, crammed floor to ceiling with natural wonders.
"Hey, hey, Sam McFarlane!"
Joe Culp came around from behind the counter, arms spread wide, and gave the man a big embrace. McFarlane didn't like to be hugged, but it seemed prudent not to object.
"What you got for me? Where you been, teaching?"
"I was teaching. Didn't work out, so I headed to Russia."
"Whereabouts?"
"Primorye."
At this, he saw Culp's face take on a faint look of disappointment. He glanced at the suitcase.
"These are Cicotealine specimens?"
"Yeah."
"All of them?"
"Trust me, these are good ones. The best. Shrapnel, thumbprints, oriented, all unique. One with a hole in it."
"Let's take a look," said Culp with what McFarlane sensed was slightly forced, artificial cheer.
McFarlane unzipped the roller bag to reveal a row of shoeboxes of sorted specimens, each labeled with a Sharpie.
"Let's take a look at the ones with remoglyphs," said Culp.
McFarlane pulled out a box and laid it on the counter. He opened it up. Inside, he had wrapped the specimens in paper towels. He sorted through them and picked out a few of the biggest, then unwrapped them. Culp brought out a velvet-colored board and placed it on the counter to keep the meteorites from scratching the glass.
"How about that?"
said McFarlane, laying his best specimen on the velvet. "Thumbprints on one side, fusion crust, totally unique." Culp grunted and picked it up, examining it.
"How'd you get these?"
"There's a lot of guys in Primorye with metal detectors that go out there, sweep the area. There's still tons of shit out there." Culp turned the piece around in his hand and finally put it down.
"What else?"
"You don't like it?"
"It's not that I don't like it. It's just that we specialize in unique stuff. This, well, there are pieces like it selling on eBay. Let's see the one with the hole in it."
McFarlane searched through the box until he found it, unwrapped it, and laid it on the velvet. Again, he saw disappointment in Culp's face, which annoyed him. When Culp didn't pick it up right away, McFarlane took it in hand.
"See?" He peered through the hole. "This is pretty unique."
"It's also pretty small. I might be able to sell it, though. How much you want for it?"
$1,200.
"Whoa, no way can I get $1,200, or even $6. Sam, you know I'd be lucky to get two."
McFarlane felt his irritation grow.
"Bullshit. It cost me $3,000 to get to Primorye. Who's going to pay for that? And I had to pay the guy who found it $200.
"Then I would say you overpaid."
"Come on, Joe. How many Cicotealine specimens have thumbprints and a hole?"
"The market's awash with Cicotealine. Just go on eBay and look."
"The hell with eBay. This is way better than eBay."
McFarlane reached into the box and pulled out another.
"Look at this. Wicked good piece of shrapnel, 200 grams, all twisted up. And this."
He unwrapped another, then another, with increasing rapidity.
"And how about this? Beautifully oriented with flow lines and fusion crust."
Culp spread his hands.
"Sam, I just don't need them." I've got meteorites, unique meteorites, selling for 90, 100 grand. This is not the kind of stuff I handle. Now, if you had a really good palisite, say, I would definitely be interested. Like that incredible Akamita palisite you brought me 5 years ago. If you could get me another slice like that, I could sell it tomorrow. I told you, I just got back from Russia. I spent my last nickel on these meteorites. Surely you need some less expensive stuff in this shop. I mean, who can afford 100 grand meteorites? That's my clientele.
McFarlane hesitated.
I'll sell you the whole collection for 6 grand. Take them all. 40 kilos of iron. That's only 15 cents a gram. Honestly, Sam, your best option is eBay. There's no shame in that. And then you wouldn't have to absorb the dealer's cut.
So after all the great stuff I've brought you, all the money you've made off me, you want to shuffle me off to eBay?
I didn't mean it that way. I'm just offering advice. You do what you want.
McFarlane felt the disappointment and rage building.
eBay, he said, shaking his head. Sam, you haven't brought me anything I can use in years. Not since that expedition to wherever it was. Bring me something good, and I'll pay you well. Really well.
I told you never to mention that expedition,
McFarlane said, rage finally breaking through the dam. He swept the box off the counter to the floor, the meteorites flying and rattling everywhere.
Culp rose. I'm sorry, Sam, but I think you should leave now.
With pleasure. And you can go ahead and keep that shit on the floor. I don't want it. Give it away to your rich fucking clients or use it for fucking paperweights, Jesus. What a rip-off artist.
McFarlane seized his suitcase and climbed the stairs in a fury, emerging onto the street. But the sudden bright light dazed him, and already he felt his fury subsiding. Son of a bitch. He needed those meteorites he'd left scattered on the floor. Those were his best. He didn't even have enough money to buy a cup of coffee. He felt a sudden overwhelming shame for his outburst. The guy wasn't in the charity business, and McFarlane knew, underneath it all, that Joe was right. The meteorites he had were run-of-the-mill specimens. The trip to Russia had been a bust. Other meteorite hunters had already cleaned out the good stuff, and he was left buying the shit everyone else had rejected. Joe had helped him before, advanced him money, financed his trips. He owed the guy $5,000, and Joe hadn't even brought it up. After a long, burning hesitation, McFarlane turned and headed back down into the shop. Joe was just putting the last of the meteorites back into the shoebox. He silently handed it to McFarlane.
Joe, I'm really sorry. I don't know what got into me. Sam, I'm your friend. I think you need to get some help.
I know. I'm a mess.
You need a place to stay tonight?
No, I'm good. Don't worry about it.
McFarlane put the shoebox back into his roller bag, zipped it up, and manhandled it back up the stairs, mumbling a goodbye. Back in the street, he wondered where he was going to get the money for a meal and a place to spend the night. Maybe he could get away with sleeping in Cathedral Park again. He felt a vibration and realized his cell phone was ringing. He pulled it out, wondering who was calling him. He hadn't had a call in days. The caller ID said Dearborn Park. Where the hell was that? Hello?
Is this Dr. Samuel McFarlane? Came the voice on the other end.
Yes.
Please hold the line a moment. There's someone here who'd like to speak with you.
Chapter 20. Evening light raked the deck of the RV Batavia, casting golden lines and shadows. An iceberg, drifting past the ship, was lit from behind by the setting sun, its edges glittering in fractures of turquoise and gold. The surface of the ocean was like a polished sheet, the air utterly still. The peacefulness of the scene, knowing how Alex would have appreciated it, struck Gideon as grotesque as he walked through the double doors into the fluorescent-lit darkness of the DSV hangar. The entire ship's complement had gathered in the cavernous hangar, oddly empty with the two DSVs from the morning dive still on deck for maintenance, while of course the third was gone. The hangar was necessary, because there was no conference room big enough to accommodate everyone. Wordlessly,
Gideon took up a position next to Glynn and Garza, standing and facing the group. The silence was absolute, but the atmosphere was anything but calm. The air was electric with tension. Gideon was numb with shock, unable to process what had happened on an emotional level, although, intellectually, it was all too horribly clear. He scanned the sea of faces, looking angrily for Leonard, who had overridden his attempted rescue of Alex. The chief officer was standing with Captain Tully, chief of security Batances, and a clump of other senior officers, staring carefully at nothing. He knew she had done the right thing. His actions were impulsive, self-destructive, but he nevertheless felt impotent rage mingling with the grief. Beside him, Glynn stood motionless, more of a cipher than ever. According to the scuttlebutt among the officers, he had apparently had a breakdown in mission control upon seeing the video of Captain Britton. He had been below in sick bay when the accident occurred, but he'd quickly recovered and now looked normal. Or rather, normal for him, with his face having resumed its mask-like detachment. He was dressed in khaki pants and a beige short-sleeved shirt, his gray eyes looking out from underneath a smooth, seemingly untroubled brow. Gideon glanced at his watch. 5 p.m. sharp. As usual, Glynn began the meeting on the very second, stepping forward. "I want to apologize for my temporary incapacitation," he said, his voice cool. This was met with an intense silence. "More important, I am terribly, terribly sorry about what happened to Alex Lispinard. I know you all liked and respected her, and that you all share my grief. It is a tragedy for this ship and for this mission. But right now, the best way we can honor her memory is by pushing ahead with our work." Another silence. "Her death was not in vain. We successfully retrieved the black boxes from the Rolvog. The boxes were hardened against many kinds of potential damage, including explosion and extreme water pressure. Unfortunately, it appears that at the moment of sinking, something caused a massive EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, to course through the ship. The boxes were electromagnetically shielded, but that EMP blew through the shielding and the storage media was compromised. The data is salvageable, at least most of it, but it will be a delicate, painstaking process. Hank Nishimura is handling data recovery." Nishimura, a tall, thin, and alarmingly young-looking fellow, wearing a white lab coat over a loud Hawaiian shirt, gave a little nod. "I'll now turn the floor over to Dr. Garza, who will provide a post-mortem on the loss of Paul." Garza stepped forward, his dark face furrowed with controlled emotion. "I won't sugarcoat things. This is tough for all of us. We're going to show you the footage we were able to recover from Alex Lispinard's DSV, which wasn't much. Only the low-res video feed had been uploaded before the sub was lost. In addition, all the LiDAR data was lost. We have some footage of the last moments of Paul taken from the camera of John, which was nearby, piloted by Dr. Crew. My own DSV, George, was too far away to capture anything beyond the UQC audio feed. Dr. Nishimura is going to run this video and audio now, without comment. Discussion will follow." He turned and a 200-inch UHC flat-screen monitor, commandeered from Mission Control, flickered into life. Gideon turned to watch, reluctantly. The trunk of the baobab appeared, in low resolution, translucent in the spectral light, giving off a greenish glow. The vantage point was from the Paul, as it circled the upper part of the trunk, shining its headlights at the entity. The light disclosed a dark object enclosed in a jelly-like sack, perhaps a foot and a half long, but with a strange, convoluted surface, wrapped by what looked like engorged veins. But the resolution was low, and the object blurry and pixelated, and he could make out no specific details. Now Alex's voice broke in. "Control, this is Paul. I see something unusual at the fork of the trunk. Something dark." "Okay. We see it too," came the voice of Chief Officer Leonard. Nishimura froze the video, showing the object encased near the fork of the trunk, digitally enhanced. "Son of a bitch," thought Gideon as he stared at the dark object. It looks like a brain. The video restarted, and now the DSV spiraled up above the level of the fork. Gideon could clearly see the mouth, with its translucent, rubbery lips gulping water, like some gigantic, revolting fish. "I think we just found its mouth," came Alex's distorted voice. The scene unfolded in enhanced slow motion. Underneath the voice exchanges, there was that low rumble Gideon had heard earlier. He watched as the DSV was sucked in. He saw Alex struggling to move the mech arm, and then the bright flash when she fired up the torch. The UQC was barely functioning, and the final video stream was little more than a blur of light and shadow. But the flash of the acetylene was unmistakable, and that, it seemed, was what had triggered the creature to react, apparently crushing the DSV. The screen went briefly black. Then Gideon's own video feed took over, and he was viewing from a distance, once again, the eruption of bubbles from the creature, probably the outrush of air from the ruptured DSV, and then came the final, inexplicable message. "Let me touch your face." This finally broke the agonized silence. From the assembled group came a burst of murmuring, expostulation, even a few suppressed sobs. Glynn stepped forward as the lights came up. "Discussion?" he rapped out. "What's going on with that last message?" It was Leonard. "Our belief, myself and Dr. Bramble, is that it appears to have been some sort of hallucination, rapture of the deep, that Alex experienced as the pressure failed on the DSV."
"That doesn't explain the timing," said Leonard. "She spoke seconds after the sub was already crushed."
A restive murmur. "That," said Glynn sharply, "is clearly a technological artifact of the UQC communication system. A delay. We're working it out."
"But it didn't come through the UQC. It was picked up on John's hydrophone."
Another burst of talk. Glynn held up his hands. "The UQC and the hydrophone used the same acoustical system. There was a lot of sonar interference from the Baobab. It's an imperfect audio delivery system. We're working on an explanation." Leonard retreated, an unsatisfied frown on her face. Prothero raised his hand. "Yes?"
"Okay. You heard that low background rumble at the very end of the tape?"
He looked around.
"Play it again."
Glynn ran it through again.
"I helped Nishimura enhance the video, and as soon as I heard that, I knew what it was."
He walked up onto the stage with a certain triumph in his face.
"Here it is, sped it up 10 times.
Prothero plugged his cell phone into one of the monitor's audio input jacks, activated it. An eerie, loon-like sound came from the speakers, half moaning, half singing. Prothero let it play for about 15 seconds, then switched it off.
"Classic. That's the vocalization of a blue whale. Your acoustic network picked up a whale somewhere in the vicinity."
"Blue whales can't dive anywhere near that deep,"
said Antonella Sachs, head of the exobiology lab.
"No, but their vocalizations can travel."